From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Didn't really matter where you stood on the issue, most everyone had the same initial reaction to the news late last month that a judge had ruled the state's ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. In Utah? This is happening in Utah? But Mark Lawrence, the director of the gay rights group that brought the lawsuit, says it was that kind of attitude that was part of the problem. Lawrence says it isn't the religious community or conservatives that were the real obstacles, it was apathy. He says people just accepted that gay marriages would never happen here. Well, they have. For 17 days, anyway. Yesterday, the Supreme Court put a hold on these marriages, and today in the program, we're talking about the legal and social dynamics in this case, how it will play out in the country's high court, and what happens next. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Yesterday's news that the U.S. Supreme Court had blocked same-sex marriages for now in Utah put a damper on the euphoria sweeping the state since the federal judge, Robert Shelby, ruled Utah's ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. But many gay rights advocates are sensing a kind of inevitability about this issue. They're seeing public opinion and legal rulings trending toward gay marriage as a right throughout the country. But if you're one of the more than 1,000 same-sex couples married in the last 17 days in Utah, you've got to be feeling a little uneasy with the Supreme Court stay. But Michael Ferguson, who along with his partner Seth Anderson received the first of these marriage licenses, put things in perspective yesterday. He told the New York Times that as remarkable as it was, he was still cognizant of the fact that this is still one of the most conservative states in the union. So for now, anyway, he's not feeling hopelessness or despair. Ferguson and others seem confident enough to see how this issue is going to play out now that the cat is out of the bag. Today in the program, we're exploring the legal and cultural questions at play in this remarkable story, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Mark Lawrence. He's the director of Restore Our Humanity. It's a local group that advocates for marriage equality. And we should say it was Mark Lawrence's idea to bring this suit against the state of Utah and the voter-approved Constitutional Amendment 3, defining marriage in Utah as between a man and a woman. And Mark Lawrence, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, I wanted you to explain how this all started. I mean, you must have heard that, Mark, you're out of your mind, that it's truly risky and maybe even reckless to bring a case like that, this, in a place like this. You could risk a bad precedent. You could get a ruling that could set the, you know, the effort. I mean, how are you thinking about all of that?
Absolutely. And a lot of that came from outside the state. Some of the national organizations, they wouldn't even take us seriously at first. And I think that what really drove me towards this was watching Judge Walker's decision with Proposition 8 in California, because we were basically in the same situation. Amendment 3, Proposition 8, they were both constitutional amendments. And Proposition 8 was completely annihilated. It was shredded in federal court. And I thought, why can't we do this? And yes, when I started talking to people about it, it was difficult to get anybody to take us seriously at first.
Did anyone say, just look, just hold off. Let us do this in the Northeast or let us do this in the Northwest?
That was kind of the response that we got from some of the national organizations. Right. Some of the local organizations here and some of the support organizations in Utah kind of stepped back.
Yeah.
We didn't hear a lot from them. And that's, of course, that's understandable. So it was mostly national that I was a little bit surprised at that.
I want you to tell me the story, if you would. You've talked about hiring this legal team, putting it together, and you've talked about the interview. You went through this process of interviewing them. Will you take me through that? Because you mentioned how within like 5 minutes you thought, we're going to be fine.
Yes, absolutely. I'd probably spoken to probably three or four attorneys. And then I sent out emails to several firms, and Jim Magleby responded, and we set up an appointment and went into his office. And we spent 2 hours actually talking and interviewing. They spent 2 hours convincing me why they were the best for this. Yeah. Now, they had me in 5 minutes,
right.
But I didn't tell them that. I just, you know, kept it going. And yes, that was the moment when I walked out of that interview. I said, yeah, this is going to happen. It was an incredible moment. So that did it.
When Judge Shelby ruled,
mm-hmm.
December 20th, where were you when you learned about it?
I was at work.
Yeah.
I work for Unified Fire Authority in the IT department. I was in the office alone. I was the only one there.
Yeah.
I got this email from Peggy. And
mention who Peggy is. She's Peggy
Tomczyk.
Peggy
is our attorney.
Yep.
Peggy Tomczyk, our attorney. It just said, we won. And I thought, okay. And I opened it up. And it's kind of a fog after that.
Yeah.
I ran out of the office, ran home, got on my computer as quickly as possible. It's about a 12-minute drive to my house from work. It took 45 minutes. It seems like. And then I went down to the county office, the county clerk's office. And it's all, it was incredible. Adrenaline. I think the way to describe it would be J.J. Abrams had walked in the room and did a sci-fi thing, and you've just been thrust into an alternate universe. That's really the only way I can describe it.
You know, I had mentioned this in the introduction, and what you hear a lot of is, again, how is it possible that that happened here, this thing in Utah? And one thing that you've said is that attitude was really part of the problem.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it was the apathy. People are so willing to accept the status quo and they let it go. It's not going to happen. It'll not happen here. And I've never liked that. I've never liked apathy. I've said, you know, we can change things. People can. People have been proving that all along. And I think that's what did it. I think we just caught everybody off guard. And the way the events happened, the legal team that we put together, the way they worked, what they did, it caught everybody off guard. And I think that's because of the attitudes here.
Yeah.
People didn't think it would happen.
What were you hearing when Peggy Tomczyk made that argument before Judge Shelby? I mean, this was 2 hours she mm-hmm. made this argument. I won't get you to necessarily try to distill it into just a sentence or something like that. But what was essentially she saying? How was that playing out?
What I saw, I sat and watched Peggy. She was so engaging. She was connected to the judge. He didn't take his eyes off her for 2 hours. They connected. They were talking. He would ask her questions. She would respond. She was prepared. And brilliant. I have never seen anything like that. She was passionate, and everything she said, she had facts to back her up with everything. And it was quite stunning. It really, really was. Watching her work was something I've never experienced before. But it was just watching her connection, the way that she talked to the judge and the way that they interacted. It was amazing.
Did you get any sense from the judge that a particular point seemed to be resonating?
Yes. Yes. Actually, the judge brought up a lot of questions. He asked both sides a lot of questions. And the point that I think that I noticed that was really important to him is when they started using the procreation argument mm-hmm. and saying, well, why can't gay people be able to procreate? Why can't they be parents? And this is what he pushed mostly the state on. Why? How do you explain this? And I think that what we've tried to do and Peggy tried to do was try to get this out of the argument because it's not about procreation. The state claims that they want to forward responsible procreation. Well, then how does denying the people who are least likely to procreate, denying them marriage, how does that forward that? And I think the judge was trying to get everybody to focus more on that.
Mm.
And it wasn't resolved.
So the state's case, the case that seems like they've been making all along, from when they first argued this as a law, it was a group of state lawmakers mm-hmm. doing it, to the case they're making now, mm-hmm. it seems, and we'll get some other perspective later on the program, but it seems like it's less a legal case is one based kind of on sociology. I mean, mm-hmm. this idea that it's predicated on a kind of moral principle?
Yes. Yes, we've seen that a lot. And it seems like the state has been trying to sidestep that and skate around that, but still keep that the central point of the issue without coming right out and say this is about morality. And, you know, you can walk down State Street and talk to 50 different people and get 50 different opinions on morality. And that's not something that belongs in legislation.
You mentioned that when at the various meetings where this was debated, Amendment 3, what was the tenor of that conversation? When you were up on Capitol Hill hearing some of this, I'm sure.
Yes, yes. That was quite, I mean, when you look at, you pull the records, Peggy brought this up in court. It was used as evidence in court. When you look at the actual records from the debates up on Capitol Hill during the Amendment 3 debates, it's horrible.
The language. Used by state lawmakers.
Yes, absolutely. Morality and all of these terminology that I don't even want to think about. But yes, it was up there. It's in the record. And it was horrifying.
You think Judge Shelby responded to that, the sort of discriminatory nature of what you sense in that language?
I think that he accepted Peggy's conclusions on that. I think that he understood. Her point was, yes, there is animus embedded in Amendment 3. The state has said there was not, but it's in the record. You can read the voters' information packet, and you can see it in there. And I think that the judge really did see that. I think he agreed with Peggy on that.
The state also reasoned in its application to the court that it had no burden based on Supreme Court precedent to actually, and I want to quote this here, prove its views on marriage are correct or sound.
Yes.
Now respond to that, because here's what the state wrote. The state wrote, the research discussed, and we're talking about the sociological research related to how, for example, children may fare in same-sex unions, those kinds of things. The state wrote that the research discussed here briefly sketches what Utah and its citizens could rationally believe about the benefits of limiting marriage to man-women unions. Mm-hmm. So it didn't have to be proved. It didn't have to be conclusive. It didn't have to be peer-reviewed. It just had to be something, according here, to what Utahns could rationally believe. Now, what do you make of that?
I didn't know what to make of that. Now, that point was brought up a couple of times. That was irrelevant. That doesn't matter. But they were asked direct questions from the judge, and it's irrelevant.
You mean he was saying, all right, prove your studies here. And they were saying, it doesn't matter. We don't have to prove them to you, Judge.
Exactly. This is our evidence, and this is what we say, and we don't have to prove it to you. They said that several times. Judge Shelby tried to help them, coax them to say something, make sense out of this, help me out with this. And it didn't happen. They would make statements like that, yes. We don't have to prove it.
Did Judge Shelby seem convinced by this argument that children of same-sex unions were being harmed? I mean, that seemed to be one of the cases.
No, not at all. I don't think so. That whole argument is so difficult to prove, and I think he understands that. With the amount of evidence that there is no solid evidence that proves that.
And but you got a sense that he was trying to get the state to say, all right, show me some kind of evidence, and let's at least.
Like I said, he was almost putting words in their mouth. Say these words and give them back to me and tell me what it is that you're saying here. And that was their response. They didn't have one.
Do you believe the attitude is shifting here?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm not talking about among the gay community, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not talking about among sort of, political, liberal, or progressive sorts. Mm-hmm. You think it's shifting among everyone?
Absolutely. I mean, we can look at the national numbers and the national average, but I don't even know how many people have told me that they voted for Amendment 3 and they would not today. And this is, again, these are numbers they're throwing out, the 66% of the electorate. Well, it wasn't. You know, keeping in mind that in that year, there was only 59% of the eligible voters showed up to vote, 66% of them. That makes it closer to 40% of eligible voters voted for Amendment 3. I don't think that number would hold today. Things have changed tremendously in the past 10 years and here in Utah as
What's changed?
Well, the national attitude has changed. There's a lot more support for marriage equality now than there was 10 years ago. And the reason for this is because gay people have come out of the shadows, come out of the closets, and we have shown the world, hey, we're here. We're your brothers, sisters, cousins, coworkers, and neighbors. People are getting to know us now. And they're finding out we're not as horrible as everybody thinks we are. So it's changed, and it does change here in Utah. You can even see, I mean, look at the campus of BYU. They have a gay, some kind of gay support groups down there, and they're talking about it now. And that wasn't going on 10 years ago.
I think it's a generational thing in some
yes,
way.
Yes, absolutely. When you look at the numbers, I mean, at 70% support, people are under, I think it's under 33, are supporting marriage equality now. It's absolutely a generational thing.
You've identified 2004 as a kind of turning point for the issue. Mm-hmm. Explain what was going on. This was an election year, of course.
Yes.
George W. Bush and his campaign, they decide to make gay marriage a political issue, and I guess you seem to think it backfired.
Absolutely, it did. I think that they were trying to distract the electorate from other things that were going on. So let's create a wedge issue and get some discussion going. And they decided, well, let's attack the gays. They won't do anything. Marriage equality wasn't even on the table. We weren't talking about it. They're the ones who brought it up. And yes, I think it absolutely backfired on them. And the thing that's really interesting about this is we're talking about a gentleman named Ken Millman, who was the chairman of the RNC at the time, and he was George W. Bush's campaign manager. Yeah. Came out of the closet a couple of years after this and went, wow, I'm sorry. So it's pretty ironic. We see so much irony here. And I've told people, I says, you know, what it really boils down to is we could probably thank George W. Bush for where we're at right now. It's quite possible it may not have happened if they hadn't started this.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned those voter packets that were being distributed during the campaign related to Amendment 3. And they noted that the amendment may not stand up in federal court. Are you saying
Absolutely.
The state probably should have seen this coming?
Yes. I don't think this is any surprise to the state at all, because it is actually in the packet. They said this may not stand up to a federal challenge. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that it's taken this long to challenge it at a federal level.
It's interesting. You seem a little relieved by this day yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a way to put it?
Yes, yes. People need to understand that this is not the end of it. This is just we need a break. It's time to take a break, rest, step back, relax, and regroup. This is actually a good thing. It's going to slow the momentum down a little. We can focus in on fundraising and some of our other efforts, and the legal team can, you know, gather more resources together. So the stay is it's a good thing.
Yeah. So what now? What are you expecting now?
What we're expecting now is we're just going to continue fundraising. As you know, the state has made this big announcement. We're going to spend $2 million defending the state against this horrible thing. Well, our attorneys are working strictly on donations. And we do not have costs and fees built into the lawsuit. This lawsuit is not going to be dumped onto the taxpayers of Utah. We are paying for this. And it's
why?
All donated.
Why did you decide to do that? Was that a principle that was important to you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, yes. Yes, because I wanted this to be a community effort. Mm-hmm. I wanted this to be us and our allies and our friends. Let's get together and change this. And that's just pretty much how it's worked out. And we do have these tremendous legal bills right now we have to pay, and they're not, you know, they're not being paid as quickly as I'd like. But now with the stay in place, we're able to focus on that. We're getting some more attention from some of the national organizations, of course, now. All of a sudden, we have their attention.
Have you said I told you so to any of these people?
Indirectly,
in so
yes.
Many terms?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah. It's like, hello. Yes. It's been good. I think that we're going to start doing very well with our fundraising efforts, though, because people now can see this happened. We're getting a lot of offers for help. Some offers we don't need, but that's okay. It's good.
Mark Lawrence, director of the group Restore Our Humanity, which advocates for marriage equality. Mark Lawrence, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being with us. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West and KUER. The
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring some of the dynamics in the case of gay marriage here in Utah in the wake of the astonishing ruling late last month. About 1,000 gay couples were married yesterday. As you've heard now, the U.S. Supreme Court granted the state's request to put further marriages on hold while they appeal that ruling. Today, we're considering how the case is going to play out in courts. The case is made on both sides of the issue. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Lynn Wardle. He's the Bruce C. Hafen Professor of Law at Brigham Young University, focuses on family law, has been involved in the issue of same-sex marriage, is opposition to it, I should say, for a number of years now. He's joining us today by phone from his office in Provo. And Professor Wardle, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I've asked Mark Lawrence earlier where he was when he heard about Judge Shelby's ruling. Where were you?
I can't remember. It's not the sort of thing that I remember, like, where were you when you heard that John F. Kennedy had been assassinated? I can answer that. I was eating lunch on the lawn at my high school and with other 11th graders, and it was stunning. But this is, you know, this is a Bush League, and I honestly can't remember.
What do you mean Bush League? You've got about 1,000 people who were married, and you're very disappointed by that fact. I don't understand what you mean.
No, I'm not disappointed. I'm not surprised. I think
Wait, you're not disappointed?
I'm not disappointed. The marriages are illegitimate. They will be declared null and void in due course. And if people want to view this as an opportunity to send a message about what they believe, well and good. If I were a gay man and I had the opportunity to send a message, I would probably go out and get married likewise. But insofar as the validity of the relationship, it will not last. Unless the ruling is upheld, and that would be quite extraordinary, because the ruling is remarkably thin. I mean, not in length. It's very, very wordy, very long, very verbose, but there's just very little content to it. I read through it, and I thought, where is it? Gee, there must be something in here. It's something really hidden nugget that really is the strength of the opinion that people have overlooked, and here it is, and it's just not there. It's just color by the numbers kind of an opinion, and it doesn't bear the weight of the judgment.
It seems that what the judge was saying, there are a number of things here, of course, but Judge Shelby's contention seemed to be that Utah's ban violates constitutional rights, due process rights, and equal protection rights. I mean, those are quite significant, whether you agree with the judge or not. That does. I'm not sure how you can say that doesn't seem fairly weighty, at least in terms of its legal.
Well, in our society, everybody claims a constitutional right for everything. I have a constitutional right to have my ham and eggs served while they're hot. You waitress have violated my constitutional rights. I have a constitutional right to watch my favorite TV show, and by changing the TV show, they've violated my constitutional rights. I mean, it's that quality of constitutional right. It's a matter of constitutional text or history or substance or precedent. It's simply non-existent. It's a house of cards. It's a pretty feeble matter of real law or real constitutional principle. It's got great political rhetoric in there. If I were running for office or going to give a speech on the floor of the legislature, I'd quote parts of it. It's wonderfully rhetorical, but just not much substance legally.
Then tell me, what's the legal flaw? The essential, if you could boil it down for me, the essential legal flaw in Judge Shelby's ruling.
There are two of them, they both come under the category of judicial restraint, that judges who have tremendous authority and tremendous power also have the responsibility to restrain themselves from exercising that power in a way that simply promotes their own personal preferences, that stretches and strains the constitutional principles that they're supposed to be applying for the purpose of promoting a personal policy preference. And that's it in a nutshell, the lack of judicial restraint. And there are two dimensions. The one dimension is separation of powers, that in our society, in our democracy, in American federal and state governments, the authority to make public policy resides with the representatives of the people. We are, after all, a democracy.
Yeah.
We are, after all, looking to let the people, let their values and their voice underlie and define laws and legal policies. So, number one.
But let me ask you to respond to that, though, just while you're on that point still. How is this, Professor Wardle, different from the argument being made during civil rights, for example, that you cannot deprive people of their constitutional rights, even through a democratic process, that voters in the South, for example, were overwhelmingly, we know, in support of Jim Crow laws and other laws that deprived African Americans of basic rights? But how is this different? Through a democratic process, you deprive people of what they believe is their constitutional right to be married.
That's an easy question with an obvious answer. We had specific constitutional amendments that addressed the issues that were the basis for the civil rights holdings. We fought the most bloody, disastrous, devastating, destructive war in our nation's history, leaving 600,000 bodies dead on the fields in order to lay the foundation and establish the principles that are articulated in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. That's the legitimacy of those rulings. We fought that horrible war and through proper constitutional processes adopted amendments that explicitly address issues of racism in our society. End of discussion. Now, the federal courts and many state courts for about 70 or 80 years thereafter simply looked the other way and said, okay, we're going to pretend those amendments don't exist. They violated and abused their power by refusing to enforce the will of the people that had been embodied in those constitutional amendments, adopted through a very important constitutional process, vindicating and establishing the principles that were the basis for that horrible conflict, the Civil War. Mm. We have no similar a constitutional amendment or any similar expression of constitutional consensus on the issue of same-sex marriage in the nation today. The closest we have is constitutional consensus on the other side, in the other direction. The people in 30 states have voted for and adopted, actually 31 until until the flaky federal court judge Von Walker struck down Prop 8 in California. There were 31 states, but 30 states have constitutional amendments adopted by the people, by the vote of the people, that define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. That's a pretty clear constitutional consensus against same-sex marriage. Show me the powerful constitutional consensus in the nation that suggests that the social values of the people of this nation, of the citizens of the states of this nation, support same-sex marriage, not just with a little poll here or there, but with the consensus of support. Show me the evidence for that. You can't, because it doesn't exist. The evidence is on the other side, evidence of strong, powerful consensus against same-sex marriage, manifest in those 30 or 31 state constitutional amendments adopted and approved by the citizens of those states.
So let's say there can be, let's say there is a consensus that gay people ought to be married, then you would be for it.
Well, then you'd at least have a plausible ground for saying that even though we haven't followed the proper procedure for amending the Constitution, maybe we can justify the court in ruling this way because we've got this massive social consensus in favor of it. And sometimes the court gets a little ahead of the country and we might justify it there.
Yeah.
Then it might be at least not as illegitimate. It would at least reflect some value consensus in the country that would have some claim to being respected, but that simply doesn't exist.
Professor, I want to ask you about, you've written about the state's, what you call the state's interest in what you've called responsible procreation, saying that for a same-sex couple to have children, they have to have some sort of relationships outside of marriage, which complicates parenting and the institution of marriage itself. It, the state now has, it seems like, abandoned that strategy of procreation in the case they're making. Do you agree with that? What role do you see procreation playing in this marriage debate now?
Well, I'm not familiar with what the state has or hasn't done in terms of the making or not making that argument.
Well, they're no longer making the case related to procreation. They seem to have abandoned that. They're no longer making the case of so-called responsible procreation.
Yeah. Well, the responsible procreation case is a little more sophisticated than you've summarized it, although I think you made a good faith effort to do so. The responsible procreation argument is that every child deserves, whenever possible, to be raised by his mother and his father, and to be raised by in a marriage, which provides the most stable environment and the most beneficial and advantageous environment in which a child can grow up.
But that's not that's not the procreation argument. That's an argument related to whether or not a child should have a man and a woman as a parent. That's not the question that the state has made in the past, at least as I understand it, and maybe I don't. But the case that had been made in the past, as I understand it, was that it was that one of the essential elements of any marriage was that a couple could procreate. It had nothing to do with how you cared for your children, but the essential biological fact of procreation. Now, am I reading that wrong?
Well, you're reading my argument wrong. My argument has three elements. It's not just the procreation, but it's the rearing of the children. It's the environment into which they're born. It's responsible procreation, that is, responsible sexual behavior that leads to procreation. Responsible procreation, that is, the birth of the child into the environment that is most advantageous, and the responsible carrying on of that environment, raising the child in the environment that provides the best opportunity for the child to flourish and to develop and to reach and achieve full stature without being deprived of relationships that are valuable for the child's development and growth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got those three steps to it, and yeah. You know, I've articulated that in a Harvard Law Journal, Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy argument article some time ago, but procreation affects marriage in many ways. There's a powerful linkage because marriage provides the best environment for procreation to occur. That is, the safest environment for the expression of sexual love is marriage. The safest environment for a child to be born in, to be conceived and procreated and to be born into, is a marriage environment.
But if
and the safest environment for their raising, for them to develop, is a marital environment.
But Professor, if you set the standard of best or ideal environment, doesn't that put you in the position of arguing that heterosexual couples who have histories of alcohol or drug abuse or of certain mental illnesses or have a certain kind of psychological profile makes them not ideal parents? By that logic, should they also be deprived of an ability to marry?
No, because those are unique or inherent to the those are individualistic characteristics, many of which can change. We all get old. We all get sick. We all have challenges and afflictions in our life. That doesn't disqualify us from marriage. But in terms of the very qualities and characteristics that we bring to the relationship, they don't change. I'm a man. My wife is a woman. Those gendered identity and gendered characteristics remain with us. That's quite different than two men or two women. The fundamental point is that men and women are different in profound and important ways, and the union of a man and a woman creates a union that is different than the union of two men or the union of two women. Mm.
I don't mean this question to be facetious, but I'm sure you've heard the observation that More than 1,000 same-sex couples have now been married in this state. People have been married in New York and in Iowa and Minnesota and Rhode Island and various other places. And as I'm sure you've heard it put, the earth didn't come to an end. Things didn't really change in many ways. That now people are married. Your marriage is still legitimate. Heterosexual couples still have legitimate marriages. How are you responding to that argument, which I'm guessing you've heard anyway?
Yeah. Well, the Chicken Little argument that the sky didn't fall proves nothing. You could have made the same arguments about every major disaster that's occurred in our nation's history and every terrible policy disaster that has occurred in our laws. The effects are going to be felt and seen in the schools where children are taught, is marriage is the union of a man and a woman, or is it just the union of any two people, regardless of gender. It's going to be seen in the social understanding of marriage that is discussed in the media, in the newspapers, in the radio, in the television, in the conversations, because if you change the definition and the meaning of marriage, you change the institution. You change the expectations of marriage. You change the outcomes of marriage. Marriage becomes less stable, less beneficial. There are less advantages of marriage. You've diminished marriage. You've weakened marriage. And it's the poor, it's the aged, it's the sick who suffer the most when the institution of marriage is weakened.
Lynn Wardle, law professor at Brigham Young University, joined us from his office in Provo. Professor, thank you very much for the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the legal and, I guess, social dynamics of this case of gay marriage here in Utah. In the wake of the ruling late last month, about 1,000 gay couples were married. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court granted the state's request to put further marriages on hold while they appeal the ruling. Today, we're talking about all of this, and we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go to the phones. George, who's joining us. George, welcome to the program.
Hi, Doug. This is George. I'm the pastor of the Orem Community Church. And the issue for me in marriage is to perform a ceremony if there is love and commitment to each other. The only same-sex marriage I have had was a couple who had been together for 15 years. They have two children born by one of the women. And the quality of their love commitment to each other was the factor to allow me to perform the wedding. They're excellent parents, they both work, and provide well for the family. So to me, marriage of same-sex persons does not hurt the traditional marriage of a man and a woman. It only allows others with a love commitment to also live as married persons. Mm-hmm. So that's my comment. If you had any questions, I've been at this for 50 years as a pastor, and most of my weddings, of course, have been with a man and a woman. Yeah. But the issue is love and commitment between a couple. That's the issue to whether to perform the ceremony.
Right. George, thanks. Glad you called. Let's see. Stephen in Salt Lake City. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you, Doug. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the comments made by the BYU professor. Forgive me for not recalling his name offhand.
Professor Wardle. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you. First of all, the purpose of the Constitution is to protect the rights of the minority as well as the majority, and we've seen that throughout the history of the civil rights struggle. Second, the basis for Judge Shelby's decision was that the state did not prove a rational basis for distinguishing between marriages between homosexuals and heterosexuals. the state's argument was much the same that the professor just made, that it would somehow detract from the value of heterosexuals' marriage. There simply is no evidence of that. When I was in college a long time ago at the University of Utah, I wrote a paper on gay adoption, and the studies that I found suggested that, you know, the children raised by gay couples did just as well as the children of heterosexual couples. But we also have to remember that there is a number of reasons that we have marriage, some of which are property rights. It's a multifaceted thing. Also, just societal values showing that we acknowledge that homosexual couples have the right to love one another and have a committed relationship and enjoy the same rights that other married couples have. It doesn't necessarily have to do with children.
Stephen, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's get some perspective on that. Timothy Johnson is with us. He's the Morse alumni. Timothy Johnson is political science and law at the University of Minnesota, where he focuses on judicial politics and the Supreme Court's decision-making process. And let me ask you, so first, I guess the big question now comes, do we have a clue of how the high court is thinking about this issue, really? Any sense of this yet? Because most of it seems like the things that they've been doing in the past have been more procedural than based on merits or any kind of ideology.
I think that's right. I mean, so far the court has really dealt with procedural issues, with the exception of the decision in Windsor to overturn the DOMA law that had been in effect since the Clinton administration. But by and large, I mean, I think that this court is taking sort of a judicially conservative position, and I don't mean ideologically conservative, I mean judicially, and by that I mean they are trying to wait, if you will, for more information and more decisions from lower courts. The way that the Supreme Court really works, not only on issues that are salient like gay marriage, but also on issues that the public cares less about, antitrust law or tax law, for instance, is that they take a very slow approach, and they really want to make sure that all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted, and they want to hear from the Tenth Circuit, and they want to hear from the Fourth Circuit and the First Circuit and hear what the arguments are on both sides. And then when they see if there's conflict that exists between those federal appellate courts, then they are much more likely to act. So you're right. Currently, this has really been a procedural issue for them.
So let's say the Tenth Circuit upholds Judge Shelby's decision.
Sure.
And it goes to the Supreme Court. And I guess they have this big decision to make. Do they take on the case themselves and make, you know, a kind of definitive sort of ruling, or do they just let the Tenth Circuit make the ruling? Because you say they prefer to let the lower court actually make the law. If they can put it off, they'll try.
I think that's right. Especially in highly salient cases, they will try. That said, this is one of those issues, sort of like the justices finally felt in 1971 when they finally took Roe versus Wade. They finally felt that there was that the law and public opinion and all sorts of external factors finally got to the point that they had to make a decision about a woman's right to choose.
Right.
And there will come a point here in the next couple of terms, and I would probably say fewer than five terms, and probably more likely the next 2 to 3 terms, where they're going to have to put this on their docket and make a decision. Now, interestingly, probably there's no way they can make that decision this term. If you look, and my colleague who just spoke with you made it clear, right, that the briefs for the Tenth Circuit aren't even due to be finished coming into the Tenth Circuit until the end of February.
Right.
The Tenth Circuit in Denver also hasn't set then a date for an oral hearing there or the oral arguments. And that means there's no way the justices will decide this by then. And from their point of view, by that I mean the Supreme Court justices in Washington, that's probably a good thing because there are other cases that are percolating at sort of the same timeline as the Tenth Circuit case, and therefore they'll have decisions from these various circuits. I wouldn't be surprised if they put this Utah case on their docket for next term, and maybe they would hear oral arguments in December or January next year, but it's probably too soon right now.
So this is how it works, I guess, is that they want this to be an orderly
kind of a glacial process. I mean, you've pointed out the Brown versus Board of Education decision didn't just pop out in 1954. You talk about how this was a process that was really beginning in the early 1900s.
That's absolutely right. So by the 1920s, when the court was beginning to hear anti-miscegenation cases, and then in the 30s and the 40s, and when they were hearing cases about whether or not professional schools like law schools or medical schools could ban African Americans from going there for school. And it then, you know, the dominoes continue to fall. But you're right, it was this sort of glacial process. And to be perfectly honest, that's generally how the law works. Now, in this particular case, we've seen that some of the dominoes already fall. So in the mid-1990s, the court decided Romer versus Evans that said a state can't pass an amendment to its constitution that outwardly discriminates against you if you're homosexual. And in the early 2000s, they decided Lawrence versus Texas that says a state cannot pass a law that says that homosexuals cannot engage in sexual activities in the privacy of their own home. And so these dominoes are beginning to fall. And then you add to that the Windsor case from last term. Mm-hmm. And either the case that will emanate from the Tenth Circuit or one of the others in the next few terms will ultimately be that final domino to fall.
So there's a kind of inevitability to all of this, do you think, that the country's kind of reached this sort of social cultural turning point and that gay marriage in many ways is really just a matter of time?
I think that's right. And if you look at Justice Kennedy's opinion in Lawrence versus Texas, and he really does point to, much to the chagrin of his colleague Justice Scalia in particular, he points out to this national consensus about the rights of homosexuals. And I was actually really taken aback by your discussion a few minutes ago about public opinion, because, in fact, if you look at public opinion polls going back to around 2010, 2011, there is a consistent 54 to 55 to 56% of Americans across a wide array of polls and across a wide array of questions, question wording that supports gay marriage. And it's that sort of consensus that Justice Kennedy pointed to in a warrant. And I would guess that's the sort of consensus that the Supreme Court justices would point to when they take a case to finally make this decision.
I guess this shouldn't surprise anyone that there's a bit of a political back and forth going on here. You've talked about it as you've mentioned that there's just so much political capital that the Supreme Court or a Supreme Court, Chief Justice can spend, which is not unlike a member of Congress or a president, I suppose. And you just have to be judicious about how you spend it.
I think that's right. Again, you know, we can talk about the idea of justices being restraintist or being activist. I think across the board, whether you're an ideological liberal or an ideological conservative, most justices on the Supreme Court, and I would suggest most judges, either in the federal circuits or in federal district courts, are restraintist by nature. That's how they are taught in law schools. That's the entire society within which they have been socialized. But these justices and judges also know that there are times when you act more activist. And, you know, I think that Chief Justice Roberts has actually shown that in the decisions that he made, not only on the ACA case, but also in the Windsor case last term. And you saw the Supreme Court, to go back to Brown versus the Board very quickly. After the Supreme Court decided Brown v. the Board, the Warren Court, which was one of the most activist in history, became quite restraintist because they knew, Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, knew that the court had spent so much political capital on Brown that it probably wanted to pull back a little bit, and therefore it did for several years in the late 1950s.
So this question, I'm not sure what you were hearing from Professor Wardle, but it seems like for a long time the case made by the state of Utah and others was related to these sociological studies. What is in the best interest of children? How do we define the kind of social, you know, dynamic of what a marriage might be? What's going to happen to those arguments as this plays out, do you think?
You know, I do suspect that those arguments will continue to be made, but I suspect that they will be largely ignored by the court. I mean, I think the court is going to be much more persuaded by equal protection type arguments, and I suspect, whether it's a good argument or not, that that's where both sides are going to lay most of their claims. And I do ultimately suspect, although I don't like making public predictions, that if the court has to deal with that issue, it will say something to the effect of, it is perfectly fine if you want to have a specific definition of marriage within a particular religion, within a particular church, but as far as the state is concerned, you cannot exclude any one particular group from marrying.
How significant was it that in the Windsor ruling that Justice Kennedy actually referred, and it seems like in kind of a poignant statement referring that to the fact that the children of gay and lesbian couples would be demeaned by depriving them of their rights to marriage?
I can see that type of argument continuing to be used, but not as the basis for a decision, just right. As sort of what we call in the legal field dicta, sort of the fleshing out of an argument. And I actually think that sort of argument may be there, but it will either be there in the footnotes or it will be buried within the analysis that says, look, ultimately this is an equal protection issue, and if there is an equal protection violation, then we need to make sure that this particular class of people is protected. And then here are maybe some of the reasons why it's good that we protect them, one of them being that it's just going to be better for these children if their parents are married to one another despite their sexual preferences.
Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left.
Sure.
So you mentioned the time frame. Somewhere within 5 years you think this could happen. What's the likelihood of the Utah case? How strong is the Utah case as being maybe the clincher, one of the crucial ones?
I find this an interesting case because this is the most ideologically conservative state to have this particular case come out of, right? So this is not a case coming out of California or New York, which is what the Prop 8 case or the Windsor case were. This is a case from a state that has very strong feelings about issues like same-sex marriage. And so I suppose it's possible that this is the one. I think ultimately what the court will probably do is consolidate this case with one, maybe two others that come from some other key southern states or key states that are more opposed to gay marriage, and then they'll make that decision. So will it be the one? Maybe not, but it might be one of the two or three.
Timothy Johnson, political science and law professor at the University of Minnesota, joined us from Minneapolis. Professor, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.